that beat frequency is set up in the brain, and if you looked at the brain on an EEG at that moment, you would see brain coherence, both hemispheres pulsing in unison to that pulse rate. And for some applications, kind of interesting, you know, for accelerated learning as an example, to be able to put your brain into that ideal band for learning, for absorbing information. There's instruments that have been developed for that. There's things that have been developed for increasing meditation capacity, relaxation, lots of things for altering brain activity using either light or sound as examples. You can also use electricity, electromagnetic fields. I do a workshop where I actually demonstrate a bunch of this, and I think Leon might have caught part of that when I was in this area last. But with that, electromagnetic fields, they actually have electrocranial stimulation, which they use, again, for altering brain activity for specific applications. And these are things used not by militaries, but in the civilian sector. What the military looked at is, okay, if we can create these kinds of reactions, can we enhance our troops' performance, and at the same time, can we use these kinds of concepts for degrading our adversaries' performance? And from that, in the 80s, became this huge effort for creating non-lethal weapon systems that would do that. If you remember a few years ago, the one that the Marines announced, and it looks like a big dish mounted on a Humvee, and the story was that it was for riot control and that they would hit people with this microwave energy and it would create the sensation of heat on the surface of the skin so you'd feel like about 130 degrees temperature sensations. Wouldn't create burning unless it was improperly ranged. I mean, if you're ranging it for a mile and someone walks 10 feet in front of it, you got other problems because of the energy densities that are involved. But this was the idea, you know, that you would be able to heat people up, you know, and get crowds to disperse and so on. You know, the last time burning people was used was about 500 years ago, and we decided burning people at the stake wasn't such a humane idea. And here we are bringing the very concept back. What they didn't say is that by altering that device in terms of energy density, waveform, pulse rate, any number of parameters, you can create much, much different effects. Those effects they well understand because they've had those effects analyzed. In other words, they have figured it out. This radio frequency dosimetry handbook was developed based on earlier work that was done. It was a technical document, and it was called Low Intensity Conflict in Modern Technology, 1984, Maxwell Air Force Base. And what this laid out was sort of these anomalous things in human physiology where they found this non-ionizing low levels of energy could create these dramatic effects in the body and in the brain. When you go back even further in history, if you go back to 1969, there was a book called Unless Peace Comes. And within that book was a chapter called How to Wreck Your Environment. Now, this was before Earth Day, so you could get away with a chapter title like that, and it was taken fairly well. In fact, the concept was that chapter was written by G.F. Gordon MacDonald. He was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson when he was president. He was also a professor at UCLA. And what he said back in 1969, he said, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way, we could return a signal to the Earth that would have an impact on the emotional state of human beings underneath that field. That's pretty interesting. Didn't have the technology in 1969. By the time HARP came around, that technology is in fact there. This is one of the side effects that have been recognized by Russian scientists when the Russian Duma, about, I think it was August 11th, 2002. It might have been the 9th. I'm usually pretty good on that stuff, but you can check either one. If you look at Pravda and who is it? The Interfax News Agency did a press release on this. And they actually came forward and said the very things that we had expressed concern about regarding HARP and its effect on human physiology, their scientists finally came forward, objected on the same grounds, along with the environmental impacts and other impacts, and came forward. They passed a resolution. That came actually 3 years after a resolution of a similar nature was passed in the European Parliament that we had a lot to do with. We had been invited over. This is interesting because how politics works on this in Europe is so much different than what happens here in the U.S. The first people that contacted us on HARP in Europe was a gentleman by the name of Tom Spencer. He was a conservative in the European Parliament. At that time, he was chair of the Environmental Committee. You know, that kind of doesn't fit, you know, in terms of how we think of environmentalism in the U.S., a conservative chairing the committee. But in Europe, they've progressed beyond where we have, where we're just seeing the U.S. start to recognize environmentalism as something that's relevant to everyone who breathes, regardless of your political affiliation. Tom, then, he brought us over. We brought a number of documents with us, you know, just as an example, how he found us. You know, that's an interesting story. Someone just like you heard us on radio talking about this issue, got our book, sent it to him. They're all marked up copy. He read it, called us, went back to his scientists in Great Britain, said, what's the story on this? And he kept getting this answer. Stay away from it. You don't want to get involved. And Tom Spencer is a unique kind of politician. For him, that was the ticket to the dance. You know, it's like that's why he got involved. What happened in the interim is we made several trips over. He set up forums for us to present. We delivered probably 300 documents, non-classified documents that were publicly available, and that began to set the stage for the debate. In the interim, we had gotten contacted by the Greens in the European Parliament, and we asked them, are you working with Tom Spencer? No, he's not interested in these issues, you know, from his perspective. He's pro-military, blah, blah, blah. So, no, you need to talk with him. That was the beginning of a coalition between the Greens and the Conservatives on this issue. The next thing that happened is we made a trip over and we pulled the Social Democrats in, and this became part of a security and disarmament resolution that was a multi-page resolution, voted on paragraph by paragraph, and our section specifically dealing with HAARP were passed by the largest margins. And, you know, in all of that, I'll give you the citation. It's a European Parliament resolution, A40005/99. And what happened in this is, going back, we first talked about it with Tom. We brought the information in. He ran it by his scientists. That brought in a whole lot of other people to the discussion. We then began to set up a strategy for how would we introduce this concept and tie into this concept the non-lethal weapons technologies that were emerging very rapidly in the U.S. and being pushed on our allies in Europe. So Tom and I ended up in this conference. It was a group called GLOBE, and it's 200 legislators from 44 governments, the top environmental legislators in the world. He gave us an opportunity to present to that group when he was their executive director or their president, whatever their top position was there. Coming out of that, we ended up in a conference with him called Religion, Science, and the Environment. It was sponsored by Bartholomew I, which is called the Green Patriarch, for those that don't know him. He came out a number of years ago and declared environmental degradation as a sin for the Orthodox people, representing 200 million across the world. A big, you know, shift in way thinking was done. But he developed environmental conferences. Tom and I were in one of those for 12 days together, and we laid out a strategy for bringing this issue into the European Parliament. And the strategy was we were going to debate NATO. They were going to bring NATO in. Tom, in the interim, became foreign affairs chairman, very powerful position in the European Parliament. He went to the Secretary General and said, you know, would you please come and present NATO's position on non-lethal weapons and their deployment in Europe, as well as ionospheric modification for weapons use. And NATO basically said, we have no policy on either and we're not coming. So he went to the American mission, which is responsible for what's going on with HAARP, and the American mission refused to produce anyone. And this really angered this committee, because this is the same committee NATO had gone to sometime before and said, hey, we want to bring in new member states and we need your buy-in. So they were very important to NATO at that point, but when they had an issue for NATO, NATO wasn't interested in participating. What happened is, the night before the hearing, that committee put together a closed meeting, and it was involved myself, a member from the International Red Cross, a person from the group GRIP, based in Brussels, and a woman, Rosalie Bertel, who is an environmentalist, a physician and a physicist from Canada, on our side of the equation, and two members of the European media. We met with the committee for 5 hours in closed session to give them the overview of what this was about. We demonstrated for them an infrasound device that's used and referenced in the literature in terms of non-lethal weapons, so we were able to demonstrate something that they had only heard rumor about, something that had actually been built and was demonstrable. At the end of that, we went in then the next day into the hearing. I was supposed to have 15 minutes. They gave me an hour and a half to present. NATO was in the back of the room, not participating actively in the hearing, and we opened with a document called Ionospheric Modification for Weapons Application produced by NATO France. And this is, remember, NATO said they don't have any policy on all of this. We then introduced documents from the Strategic Studies Institute in Great Britain showing the deployment and of non-lethal weapons throughout NATO Europe. Again, NATO saying they had no policy guidelines for any of it. And our suggestion to the European Parliament was engaging in these initiatives without policy guidance was as reckless as you could possibly get. 8 months later, they developed their non-lethal weapons policies. The ionospheric modification policies, to my knowledge, have never been developed. Coming out of that hearing, Santer's science and technology aide came to me and said they would pursue this, they would do a study, and they did. That study was completed, but it involved more than HARP. They dealt with everything creating electromagnetic fields from toaster ovens to intercontinental ballistic missiles. I mean, everything in between. They took a look at the literature, a literature overview, which began to set the stage to start to look at treaty dialogues surrounding these kinds of energy-based weapon systems. In HARP, one of the things that came up is, you know, can you really affect emotional states of individuals with these external fields? And the answer is yes, you can. In fact, if you go back even back into the early days of these concepts, you can go back to Zbigniew Brzezinski's work when he was at Columbia University. He wrote a book called Between Two Ages, which I really recommend you find. I'm sure there's a library that has it. It published over 170,000 copies. It's around. This book was looking at technology and its impact on globalization and what was going on in the world from a viewpoint in the early 1970s. This is before Brzezinski became the national security advisor to President Carter, just to keep that all in perspective, who this guy was and what he was saying. And in the early 70s, he made a prediction. And if you read this book, it is a book of predictions about what would happen in Europe, Africa, South America, Asia, in terms of the dissolution of the Iron Curtain, all of the things economically, socially, that have happened in the last 30 years. If you read this book today, you would swear it was a history and not a prediction, because he was dead on accurate. He writes in a very convoluted style, but it's well worth the read. But in that book, Between Two Ages, between pages 54 and 58, you'll see this little discussion about J.F. Gordon McDonald's ideas about affecting the ionosphere in a way that would influence behavior. And this is what Brzezinski essentially said is, you could change the emotional state of large segments of the population, creating either aggression or passive sorts of behavior, and you could do it with virtually no one's knowledge using this kind of a system. And what he said, which is very important from someone involved in policymaking in this country, what he said was that no matter who is in power, liberal or conservative, the temptation to use that type of technology to further their political ends would be greater than the good sense to restrain. And I'm paraphrasing the quote, but that's essentially the essence of it. You know, the idea that, you know, could we do this? In fact, if you look at it's either May 24th or 25th, 2002, The Economist, well-known publication in terms of economic issues and some social issues. The cover story on that is on mind control, manipulation of the human brain using chemical and electromagnetic means. And it's an ethical article about the ethics of doing this. The book Earth Rising, the Revolution, we took that subject a lot further away from the HARP concepts and started looking at what's all involved in that. In my background, I have a doctorate in traditional complementary medicine. My area of interest was electrophysiology, the effect of electromagnetic fields on the body, which is what got me interested in this in the very first place. Because here we were working with huge amounts of energy in ways that I know from my own work and my own research can be dramatic in terms of their effect if they inadvertently hit these window frequencies that cause these kinds of changes within our physiology. When you look at the direction of the technology, there's over three dozen patents that we cite in this book, Earth Rising, the Revolution. This book has 650 citations. The book, the first book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, had 350, and our latest had 350. These were pulled from 20,000 within our archives, documents that are reasonably classified in terms of laid out, and probably 200,000 documents that were pitched before we archived the material. So it's a lot. It represents 10 years of my work and another 5 years of another individual's work consolidating that information down. And we add probably 200 documents a month to our archives at this point. In that, what came out was this trend, this general trend of affecting human beings without long-lasting damage. In other words, it's easier to clean up the mess afterwards, is really what it boils down to. And so systems were developed to affect in three areas: affect human beings, affect hardware, equipment, computers, etc., or affect human beings and hardware by the same instrument. These three concepts show up in Chinese military journals, shows up in Russian military journals, and shows up in our own. One in particular I'd point to is an article called The Mind Has No Firewalls. It was produced by a publication called Perimeters, which is produced by the U.S. Army War College. So it's easy to find on the web. Hopefully it's still on the web, but certainly you can find it in good libraries. This article was a discussion of how to affect the human brain in a way that degrades our performance for military applications, and was a review of the literature on that subject. And one of the things that they said, and I'll just read this quote, because I think it's one that draws this into some perspective. And this is among many different bullet points about how energy can be used to affect living organisms. But the one that in particular of interest is a psychotronic generator which produces a powerful electromagnetic emanation capable of being sent through telephone lines, TV, radio networks, supply pipes, and incandescent lamps. This signal would manipulate the behavior of those in contact with the signal. In other words, what they're saying is any of these systems can be used for transferring the necessary energy at in the necessary form to affect behavior. Now, this was actually a focus of a story on February 5th or February 7th, 1999, and it was a show called Undercurrents. It's on CBC TV, Canadian Broadcasting, their public television, where they interviewed myself. They interviewed a guy named Persinger, who's a specialist in this area of manipulation of human brains using energy in Canada. He's done a lot of work for, he works at Laurentian University, he's done a lot of work for military in the U.S. The other was a guy named Smirnov, who worked for the Institute of Cycle Correction in Moscow, which he developed a technology that was actually demonstrated that would influence behavior in a similar way. The others that were interviewed were the Morrises, which were two people that were responsible for bringing with decline to the Reagan administration, this concept of non-lethal energy-based weapons. They could not talk about what was being done in the U.S., but they could talk about their experiences in the former Soviet Union and working with scientists there, and they did. And essentially what they all basically said was, this can all be done. You can use these various means to transfer a signal. And this becomes disconcerting in a lot of different ways. I mean, the Morris's position was, knowing this, the U.S. government should be aggressive in taking the position that on electronic devices that can be used to input that kind of a signal, you can actually put a circuit within those electronic devices to screen those out so that those carriers are not effective in bringing that kind of signal in. But that's not the kind of dialogue when it comes to computers and government that we normally hear about. We hear about other things like how to get into your computer to see what's going on without you knowing about it. The problem with a lot of this is it pushes the envelope. And when we did the chapter on manipulation of the human brain as an example, there's over 100 citations. Most of them are military journals, academic studies. There's a few mainstream media reports in there. But the bulk of it are academic studies showing how all of that actually works. The interesting thing, going back to HARP again, is here's a system that finally comes into play that can do exactly what J.F. Gordon MacDonald predicted in '69 and Brzezinski spoke about in the early 70s. It can electronically stroke the ionosphere in just the right way. Now we've got to roll back a little bit. Let's talk about how much energy does it really take. There was a guy named Jose Delgado. Does anybody know the name Jose Delgado in the room? Wow, just a couple. Jose Delgado got his degree in electrophysiology, University of Madrid, 1950. Most people don't even know such a degree existed in 1950, but it did. He came to the United States in the mid-60s. He worked at Yale University, and his area of specialty was the brain. And initially, his job was to map the brain, the various portions of the brain that were responsible for the various functions of our intellect and controlling the body. So he began to do that using primates and humans, using implants to stimulate electrically these various portions of the brain, see what would happen. And he wrote a book. It's called Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society, because his view of the world was, wouldn't it be great if we could manipulate the behavior of people over large areas so they would all be happy? As an example. You know, and actually somebody asked me that in a lecture a number of years ago. You know, wouldn't that be great? And the answer is absolutely not. You know, the fact of the matter is human beings are meant to experience the full range of human emotions. That is who we are. To manipulate that in any way externally is a huge step in the very wrong direction. In fact, you know, that whole concept, you know, the toughest group to convince of the reality of that concept are politicians, because they don't want to stand up and say something that someone's going to criticize them over. And this is what the European Parliament did as a result of the research we provided to them. In the last section, after dealing with HARP, they then dealt with this broader issue of manipulation of human beings. And this is what the resolution calls for in this particular paragraph. It calls for an international convention introducing a global ban on all developments and deployments of weapons which might enable any form of manipulation of human beings, unquote. That is an extremely important step along this road. The idea that journals like The Economist, Psychology Today, are beginning to discuss the ethics of manipulating human behavior. Think about the basic fundamental freedoms of the United States. Religion, assembly, speech, what is that all about? It's about what goes on in here. If they were to any concept in our founding fathers about what we really need in that, and the idea that you could actually manipulate what went on in the human brain, that would have probably been the very first thing cited in the First Amendment, because that really is the most important issue to let all those other things happen. Now we are at a point where our technology has taken us to a place that we can manipulate what happens within the human brain in terms of general emotional state. And Delgado, what he did in the 60s with implants, one of the most dramatic examples was he had a charging bull running towards him, and he flips a switch, and it affects part of the brain, and the bull stops in its tracks. If you get towards a psycho-civilized society, and you can find it in good libraries, you'll see the actual photographs of that particular test. But this is primitive compared to what emerged in the 70s and 80s. By the mid-80s, Delgado had figured out that you could affect the brain in the same way with nothing implanted and no physical contact to the body at all, using radio frequency energy in a very specific window frequency at 1/50th of the energy concentration that the Earth naturally produces. And let me put that in perspective. Today, where we're sitting, there's between 100 and 200 million times more radio frequency energy surrounding us than the Earth naturally produces, based on what mankind has done in the last 100 years. So when you talk about 1/50th of what the Earth produces, you know, you're talking about a very, very little bit of energy. And what he found was that by directing that energy at a specific person or primate, they could flip their emotional state from highly passive and lethargic to highly aggressive and active, like flipping on and off a light switch. Real dramatic tests in the mid-80s. That began to trigger a huge movement in the military's perspective as what can we do with small amounts of energy that have maybe smaller delivery systems where we can affect limited numbers of people with this kind of technology. And you'll see, and many have seen some of the sort of reports that pop up periodically. You'll see something on 60 Minutes dealing with, there was one that ran that dealt with affecting people, gave them flu-like symptoms, interfered with their equilibrium. So they would get nauseous, they couldn't fight, obviously. They're throwing up and doing all the things that happen to a person when they have the flu. The thing that began to transition in all of this was, well, you know, this is CNN appropriate. You know, you don't see it. You can disperse a crowd. You can do all kinds of things, and yet you don't necessarily kill anyone. And this is a misnomer as well, something that came up in the hearings in the European Parliament by the International Red Cross. At that time, in 98, when we did the hearing, which resulted in a resolution in 99, what was said was, you know, the idea that you could manipulate people, that you could create these kinds of effects, and that there was really no regulation on it. You know, even the chemical and biological treaties were cited in that discussion, you know, the ones that had been recently signed at that point, because they provided for certain latitudes. One of them was, whatever you did in your own country was fine. It was exempt. In other words, a chemical that you could not use against a declared enemy, you get to use at home. And we saw the results of that in Moscow when over 100 people died in a theater with a compound that would never have been permitted against their declared enemies. Our treaties, almost every one of our treaties, allow for exemptions for domestic use, and yet you don't see parallel legislation. I mean, if something's not good enough for our adversaries, I would suggest that it's not something we should use at home. And there ought to be parallel legislation running right up alongside it. What many people don't recognize is that the idea of interfering with the environment using external means, that could really be there. You know, there's a treaty that goes back to when we ratified it in 1978, and the actual treaty dialogue began in 1971, and it's a treaty that deals with environmental manipulation and forbids it. And the people that led the charge on that treaty was essentially the United States and the former Soviet Union, when by the early 70s they had realized that they could manipulate these factors without ability to model the outcomes. Because we still can't model the outcomes, you know, in terms of what we do. We can punch energy in and we can sort of hope that it all goes right. A good example of this is, coincidentally, above the HAARP facility, there was a dog leg in the jet stream, where the jet stream's kind of cruising along, moves north 50 miles, moves east 75 miles, more or less, and then drops back south 50 miles and moves on its course. You'll see this in the May issue of Scientific America. It was either 2000 or 2001. But the whole issue is dedicated to weather. And if you look in the middle section, you'll see a map of Alaska, and you'll see this little anomaly. It happens to be coincidentally right above the HAARP facility. But what that anomaly did in Alaska is it moved storm fronts out of East Texas and Louisiana into Central Florida and dropped a couple of tornadoes in Orlando, according to Scientific America. You remember that story a few years back? Now, some people said it was HAARP. And I went, no, you know, there's no evidence of that because there's no independent monitoring. But could that be? And the answer is, yeah, it could be, and here's how it works. The way they used to look at these instruments, they used to call them ionospheric heaters, because they could heat the ionosphere in certain applications. And what you would see, if you could see it, would be above the HAARP facility would be like a 30-mile diameter disk. And then from that disk, pushing it out, creating a column where the lower atmosphere then moves into that space to fill up what's been removed. And so essentially what happens in that is pressure systems change. If you have jet streams in the vicinity, you can alter their course. The very things that's come up in the HAARP planning documents in terms of manipulation of weather systems, as well as comes up in the Russian literature or the earlier Soviet literature for manipulating weather systems. And weather modification is where that treaty in the early 70s began, because the Russians were doing a lot of work, we were doing a lot of work in this area, and we had all crossed this threshold where we went, ooh, we just might totally screw this place up in a way that was more threatening at that time than the nuclear issues, which didn't result in the same kinds of agreements as aggressively as that one did. The thing that comes up later, and this is important when you talk about manipulation of environmental factors, is, you know, a lot of it becomes a little bit squishy until you start to look at what some of the big policymakers in the country are saying. This is a quote from Defense Secretary William Cohen. It's from a press conference after a lecture that he had delivered on. It was on a conference on terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, and U.S. strategy, and it was Senators Lugar, Nunn, and Cohen, while he was Secretary of Defense, delivering this presentation on these threats in 1997, so before the 9/11 event. And this is what he said in the press conference that followed. And I'm just going to read a one-liner. And it says, and I quote, "Others are engaging in an eco-type of terrorism whereby they can alter climates, set off earthquakes and volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves," unquote. That's from a seated Secretary of Defense speculating on what might be possible. When you think about that, what does that tell you about the state of our own technology? To evaluate someone else's, you have to have the basic science. The idea of creating instabilities became a big issue in the earth-penetrating tomography applications I was describing earlier. And a guy named Brooks Agnew, who was a specialist in this area, he'd actually done some work for a company most of us know about now, Halliburton, where he had actually taken a system that he had developed out to 26 well sites in 9 different states where the ground strata was known. And he used 30 watts of power, very, very little energy, but he manipulated that energy in such a way that he got a reflected signal coming back that gave him the ability to analyze the ground strata. And with a great deal of accuracy, 99% accurate, he was able to not only differentiate the ground strata and match it against those original drill logs where the information was actually known, and map that strata using very, very little energy. And what he said, and his concern was, that the kind of energy that HAARP was planning on utilizing could in fact trigger instabilities rather than just detect layers of ground. And so this becomes a big issue. There's still a lot to be said in terms of research that needs to be done in that area to see if that really could work. But when you start to see high-ranking government officials expressing concerns about unsophisticated terrorist states having this kind of technology, it tells you a lot about the technology. It tells you, first of all, that it's relatively flat. It tells you, secondly, that most of the components have to be off the shelf because it has to be something available. And thirdly, is the concepts behind that technology have to be generally understood by lots of people for them to express concern about terrorist organizations having that kind of capability. When we're talking about manipulation of environmental systems, complete environmental systems, whether it's HAARP, coupling to the machine on the Earth, changing its character as if it were just another cog in the wheel, is a very wrong approach, and one that our traditional allies in Europe have taken offense to from the standpoint that no country owns the ionosphere and no country should be allowed that kind of experimentation without a whole lot of oversight, and that oversight is not taking place. One of the other things that came up in a lot of the dialogue was sort of this direction of non-lethal weapons and sort of where that goes, which I've alluded to a little bit. But because this conference is primarily oriented towards environment, I want to talk about another major area of importance in terms of environmental systems being affected by new weapons applications. And many have heard, and just to get an idea of how many have heard, about the new low-frequency sonars used by the Navy. Okay, it's kind of mixed. Let me talk a little bit about that, because most have also heard that there was a lawsuit that was settled and everything is rosy, but I want to give you the background on this. You remember a number of years ago there was a beaching of whales in the Bahamas. It caused all kinds of controversy, and it was a multi-species beaching, which most people, you know, look at skeptically right off the bat, because when it involves a number of species, these are extremely rare, and almost in every instance they've been associated with military exercises taking place in the areas going back to the mid-1960s. What happened with this issue is we touched on it when there was an incident in the Mediterranean. We touched on it in Earth Rising anecdotally. We referenced it. We referenced the scientists and said, basically, look, this is something we need to be watching for. One of the folks that had read some of our work, a woman named Marcia Green from the Marine Mammals Institute, contacted me and said, would you consider coming to a conference in Bar Harbor, Maine, University of the Atlantic, I believe was the place. And it was sponsored by one of the commissioners of the Marine Mammal Commission. And they wanted to bring together all of the environmental organizations to look at this sonar, this new sonar, and its effect in the seas. The thing that happened in the Bahamas that was extremely valuable was on the beach were zoologists from Harvard when those whales came ashore. So they immediately took the heads, sent them up to Harvard, had them analyzed, and they determined that what they had died from was hemorrhaging. And so then they began to look at, okay, what was the cause of that hemorrhaging? And at the time in this area, they were using not these low-frequency sonars, they were using a mid-range sonar that's essentially deployed all over the oceans of the world today. I mean, these are sonars that are out there. The Navy eventually, being challenged on it, eventually acquiesced and said the only conclusion, and they delivered a study, and we cite the study, and their only conclusion was that they were responsible for this event. And actually, we took a chapter and dedicated it in this last and latest book, Earth Rising 2, on the sonars, because it's such an important issue. And when Marcia called me, I said, you know, what do you want me to present at this conference? I said, I don't really know anything about sonars. She goes, no. She goes, I want you to broaden the dialogue for the environmental community to deal with the impacts of new weapons technologies that are on the horizons, that are emerging, because nobody understands this stuff. Everyone's worrying about the traditional things that environmentalism has attacked, oil spills, deforestation, those kinds of issues. But this issue has the potential of impacting everything. So she said, come present on electromagnetic weapon systems, present on HAARP, and then use this as an opportunity to learn about sonars, and then perhaps you can get this story out in ways that we couldn't. What happened in all of that is a way that energy operates in the seas in terms of sound is much, much different than in the air. For instance, you're hearing my voice right now, and 99.97% of the energy in that transfer as it strikes your body is reflected. Only 0.03% is absorbed into tissue and not very deep unless it's a really low frequency signal that you guys all know about, right? Bull, 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 when you're driving down the road, the car next door, maybe it's your car. But the point is, you know, the energy basically is reflected. In the seas, it operates much, much differently. In the seas, when a sound wave travels and strikes tissue, 100% of the energy is absorbed into that tissue until it reaches a cavity, a gas pocket, an air pocket, the lungs of humans or marine mammals, where the energy is released explosively, causing massive hemorrhaging, that would equate to what the Navy said was the real thing, was these animals had the bends from coming up too fast. That was their story. Because the effect appears the same. You get the same effect. But, you know, these animals surface at very rapid rates for all kinds of reasons, and that's never been in the mix. But this is the equation. Marine mammals communicate using sound. You know, in the air, when we're talking about radio frequency signals, you know, shortwave, the way that radio frequency transmission travels around the Earth and gets converted back to sound, that becomes a bounce between the ionosphere, this layer I described earlier in the Earth, where the signal bounces and goes around the curvature and you can pick it up. In the seas, the things that regulate sound in the seas is salt levels, which vary with depth, and temperature. So there's a band where that sound gets trapped and it bounces and can carry very long distances with very little energy behind it. That's the way marine mammals, like whales, communicate over hundreds and hundreds of miles. It's the whisper of nature. And man, we always come in, we think the bigger deal is, why dust with a feather when we got a sledgehammer? You know, and that's how we apply natural observations initially, usually with the sledgehammer approach. Well, bigger must be better. And so this approach, when it was begin to be tested, they started having these incidents of multi-species beachings. And the important thing here is the military totally ignored the environmental impact statement process until they were challenged by a group in Hawaii and California with a lawsuit that said, hey, wait a minute, you've been testing this all over the seas, and there's no environmental impact statement. The thing that happened in that is it forced that issue. The military then pulled back and said, oh, we're not going to do anything. So the lawsuit kind of died, and then it came back, resurrected again, and they say they settled it. They didn't settle anything, and I'll tell you why. They left a couple of big holes. One is they're still doing it in parts of Asia as a part of that settlement. It's accepted, and in wartime. Does anybody know what time it is, according to this administration? You know, we're in it. So a settlement in wartime when there's a question of whether we're in it or not, and this administration is going to view that liberally, we're in a war, they're exempt. The other important thing in the appropriations legislation this last time, there was an attempt to attach as a rider. This is a very important issue because riders get attached by very powerful people to sidestep the public process of legislation. And there was a rider attached to exempt the military and the House side from all environmental regulation. Now, I don't believe that hung on, but it's going to come back around again. And this, when you look at the biggest polluters in the world, it's our military and other militaries. When you look at the sites, the cleanup, in my part of the world, a lot of it's isolated, but you can go down the Aleutian chain and it's a garbage dump from one end to the other because of what the military did there in World War II. You know, it's never been cleaned up. When you start talking about systems that affect entire global systems, which is where our technology is going, these guys need to be reined in and we need to look at what's happening. Now, I'm not saying disclose the national secrets. You know, in all the work that I've done with thousands of documents, I've never touched a classified record. And mainly because I don't need to, and I don't want to go to jail and fight that battle when I've got other things to do, which is getting this information out. And there's lots in the open literature. What happens in a lot of this is the open literature carries it so far, and then these projects go black. And what does that mean? It means that essentially nobody knows, except those doing the program, what's involved, except for a handful of selected senators and representatives that might get a piece of that information in a closed hearing. But those closed hearings, there's no experts there besides the experts selling the program. There's no challenge. There's no ability to challenge. And I'm not saying we should know all the national secrets on how to build this stuff. But conceptually, we ought to be in a position to have the debate about the concepts themselves. Should we apply these concepts? Should we interfere with weather systems? Should we, as a matter of policy, do these kinds of things? And, you know, when you start to think about it commercially, Soviets have been offering, the Russians now, offering countries and individuals their weather control technologies. You know, this has been offered. I got a call in the last couple of months from, I believe it was a big paper in Fort Worth. I think it was Examiner, but I might have that wrong. And they were interviewing me on a Russian company that was going to do a weather modification project for a local government in South Texas that wasn't getting enough rain. And so they wanted to contract with this company, bring them in and get some rain. And, you know, you might, if you live in that neighborhood, you might think that's a great idea, except the downstream effects, which cannot be modeled, can be quite dramatic and quite different than what you expect. And so weather modification as a concept, if companies and individuals feel like this is something they can do because there is no regulation, and they begin doing this in various places, it's going to create even a more chaotic system than the one that we've been observing for the last 20 years, getting more and more intense as the Earth demonstrates its inability to cope with whatever is happening, whether it's a combination of natural events and man-made events. But what we're adding on to this is technology now designed specifically for manipulating and interfering with those very systems that all of us depend on for life. And it's being done in a classified environment. In the late 90s, 40% of the Air Force budget, as an example, were for black projects. You know, that's no scrutiny, no accountability. When you think about equipment budget in the Air Force, 40% of it going for things no one gets to see, that is a huge, huge amount of money. The nature of our work started to shift a little bit in the last few years. We started dealing with technology in a broader basis and not just talking about HAARP, although it always comes back. And mainly I speak to groups with a lot more gray hair than I see in this room, which is, you know, and I'm glad to see it, because if this has been missed, I think, by activists. And when you combine this combination of young activists with elder experienced folks, I think you get the best dynamic for creating social and political change. Always has been. And it's a big missing piece. In Europe, we had that piece engaged, and it creates a lot of impetus for discussion and change. This issue and issues connected to it, you know, we've been featured on CBC, Fuji TV, Spiegel TV, Telemundo, BBC, just as examples, and yet in the U.S. we cannot get visibility on these issues. And it's unfortunate in the sense that these are the issues the military openly talks about. A good document I recommend heavily that you find it and read it, because it really sets the stage for this revolution. And it's called The Revolution in Military Affairs and Conflict Short of War, U.S. Army War College. You can get it through interlibrary loan, and I'm sure you've got that available here as well. It's a revolution in military affairs and conflict short of war, and it's produced by the U.S. Army War College, and I believe the date is 1990 or 89. And what this document did is start to set the stage for this change in the way wars would be fought. And what they said in this, going back 1989, 1990 time frame, they said, the changes that are coming are going to be so dramatic that they'll conflict with traditional American values in such a way that the American public would never allow them to be instituted, except under a condition of fear. And what they did in this paper is they said, first of all, what kind of systems are we talking about? And this, we're off the HAARP subject, all right? So we're talking about just general systems, things that they were concerned about. One of them was an EMP weapon, electromagnetic pulse weapon. This is a weapon that creates a surge of energy that attacks electronic circuits. So it causes bit errors in computers. It causes, at high energy densities, can actually melt circuitry. But you need a lot of energy for that. For just disrupting our modern electronics, you don't need so much. In fact, you can take the energy. This was written up in the LA Times and the sites in Earth Rising Revolution, but it was you could take the energy from two car batteries, as an example, to standard car batteries, run that energy into a capacitor bank, in other words, draw the energy off and store it in capacitors, and then if you release that energy in 150 billionth of a second, which is what this guy did, it creates the same energy level for that 150 billionths of a second, exceeding what the United States produces in energy. So you think about it, because what you're doing is you're taking it and then you're releasing it at a very, very quick rate. And so the amount of energy released at that very short instant of time is significant. And what it does is causes disruptions in large areas. They've developed smaller scale systems for police forces. Some of you may have seen stories on this, where they point it at a car and it affects the electronic ignition and causes a car to stop functioning, as an example. And in larger scale, would deal with things that would cover a battle environment and knock out electronics over a large area, which for modern armies and militaries is a big deal. For the unsophisticated militaries, it's not such a big deal. EMP was a big concern of the Soviets, which is why they continue to manufacture vacuum tubes as a way around it in some of their more sophisticated backup systems, because they couldn't be easily disrupted with this kind of surge of energy. When you think about it, the way they talked about it, they said, well, you know, we could use this against international terrorists or drug traffickers. Remember, 1989, before 9/11, any of this stuff. And we could actually target their planes and knock them out of the sky, and they'd crash and there'd be, you know, pilot error, no residual damage. You know, you just create bit errors on the avionics that control that flight. Then there was this discussion about, you know, what about juries and judges and convictions and presumptions of innocence and all those wonderful things that get in the way of military actions, but the rest of us kind of rely on as basic principles. And they engage in this discussion within this military paper where they say, maybe those constitutional provisions don't apply once we leave the boundaries of the United States. That is a very dangerous position. Again, overlaying these other concepts in modern warfare. The idea a constitution doesn't roll with our military, what the heck are they defending when they leave the boundaries of this country? That is what they're defending. That constitution, the objective is to pass those basic values to others, not ignore them when you leave your doorstep. That is not what this country was ever about, and that's what this paper was suggesting is in fact the case. What they went further, they didn't stop there. They started talking about a new technology within this paper for GPS, being able, geographic positioning system, being able to locate people with precision, and they were talking about using an implantable technology for service personnel going into the battlefield. First time I've ever seen an implantable technology openly discussed in military literature. And what they said was this would be used for monitoring troop movements within a battle environment so that you could know where all your equipment was positioned and where all your manpower was, because you'd be able to monitor them within a meter on the battlefield. And if you think about it, if you're in the military and you're going into combat, you know, you might not want to say no to that option. I mean, if you get captured, you know, it'd be nice for them to be able to find you with a level of precision. Well, the microcircuits are much better today. Now they can actually monitor heart rate, stress levels, a lot of biological functions, so you get not just where these people are, but what condition they're in within that battle environment. But they didn't stop there. The military said, you know, this would be really handy for business travelers because, after all, we're in a volatile world and we need this in case there's a problem, we've got to get our people out. Of course, we won't turn it on unless there's a problem. And if anybody believes that, there's a bridge out here that I got for sale. The fact is they abuse their power all of the time until they get caught, and then they back off for a little while until they get caught again, or they transfer it to somebody else and let them do it as their surrogates. A lot of things happen with private companies now because they're exempt from certain laws like the Freedom of Information Act. You can't get information on companies doing the dirty work, only the agencies that are doing the dirty work. And only a certain amount, and under this administration, they've even constrained that. And they've given people who do the kind of research that I do, they've given us a new name. Now they call us accumulators, and we're in the villain group because they consider us a national security risk. We used to be called investigative reporters, you know, because we dig out the information, put it out. Unlike reporters, say, working for the New York Times, where they got a big bank of lawyers, if I had that, I might use some classified documents from time to time and get away with it. But I'm not interested in that because you don't need it to make the points. The other thing this document went on to say, because it didn't stop there, it said, you know, these would all be great technologies if we could apply them, but Americans will oppose them. It's against American traditional values. Now, that's where you think the paper should end, right? Americans don't like it, it's military, we end it, but they didn't. They then went into two fictional scenarios where that would change. And they said the fictional scenarios were two. One, create international terrorism concerns to the point in which people are engaged in an environment of fear where they'll trade off what they believe is safety and security in exchange for civil liberties. The second thing they said, the second possibility, was international drug traffickers being villainized to the point where that became such a threat, again, fear-driven, that would allow people to give up civil liberties in exchange for having those problems dealt with. If you look at the PSAs today running on television, they link those two things together. This is not an accident, folks. Military plans for every possible contingency except one that they can't plan for, they never figured out how to plan for, and that's called spontaneous revolution. And I'm not talking about violent revolution, I'm talking about what happened in Eastern Europe, in the Philippines, and other places when people one day wake up and say, we're not doing this anymore. There is no defense against that because there is no head. There is no leadership to take out. There is no one to preempt unless you preempt the whole population. Those revolutions work very effectively, and we've seen them in our lifetimes. That's what they cannot deal with. But here's what happens in this paper. They create this scenario where you increase fear levels, and then you bring in these technologies, and that is exactly what has happened since 9/11. Some people have said, well, it was a conspiracy, 9/11. You know, I don't buy into that. What I buy into is this. It was an opportunity, not a conspiracy. Once the event occurred, it wasn't like the plan had to be written. It was already written. It had to be executed, and it was. And what did you see? The Patriot Act? How many local governments have opposed the Patriot Act across this country? Over 150 now. And yet, 200 now. And yet, what do we got? No change in the law. Now, has your congressman mentioned to you that he really regretted or she really regretted doing it? Well, ours have, but they haven't introduced new legislation to change it. You know, and ours are pretty powerful. You know, we got the chairman of appropriations in the Senate, Stevens from Alaska. He hasn't done anything, and he certainly could. He does a lot by rider, you know, in our state, in terms of getting things done. The point is, they haven't made a change. And if you look at the law, they'll say, oh, yeah, but it has sunset provisions. It's going to sunset, and everybody's rosy about that. But look at the law. There are certain provisions within the law that do not sunset. And one of them is anyone on their list of people that are suspected of being opposed to national policy. Well, that's everybody in here. Because everybody in here has opposed national policy at one point or another in our lives. And that is the American tradition that every one of us, no matter whether we agree or disagree on a lot of this, can stand behind and really agree on. That's what's being interfered with. The idea of manipulation from the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial-academic complex, I think is more appropriately today, is what Eisenhower warned about and is what has happened to us and is happening to us now. There was supposed to be a peace dividend. Where is it? It doesn't exist because there never was an intention of giving us one. The money is being reallocated in the biggest welfare system ever, and it's a corporate welfare system. Military spends more money, if you take out the entitlement programs, than all the other government agencies combined. You know, that is a huge, huge amount of productive wealth. And in the course of this, when we presented testimony at the European Parliament in 98 on this whole issue, and it was February 5th, 1998, when we presented that testimony, the one thing we said is we said the United States would unilaterally abrogate the ABM treaty on the basis that the argument would be made in the Congress, we said, that there is no Soviet Union and therefore there is no agreement. That was a year before it happened. We predicted, actually it was 9 months before it happened. We predicted it would be a year. And it was the one point out of all the points we made that the committee took exception to. Because they could not fathom the United States moving this direction without their involvement. 9 months later, when it was announced in the Federal Register that we were in fact headed that way, That is what accelerated our ability to get our resolutions passed, but it also set the stage for questioning what our government was doing with its traditional allies. And this is a huge, huge mistake to exclude traditional allies. Because just because we're on top of technology today does not mean we're going to be on top of that technology tomorrow. Every place where we have conflict is where we have interfered with someone else's domestic politics. Whether it's in Iran, Iraq, or Afghanistan, these places are all places where we've manipulated their political outcomes. We got people angry at us because of that manipulation. Manipulation we would never stand for in this country. Should we expect others to stand for it in their own? And the answer is no. Either our values travel with us or they travel against us. And today they're traveling against us because those making policy are doing it for not our interests, but for the interests that pay the bills. Things we used to call bribery, now we call a campaign contribution. The effect is exactly the same. It is exactly the same. When you think about what does bribe get you? It gets you access, it gets you opportunity, and it gets you the ability to influence a policymaker. Go in and try and see your U.S. senator or U.S. congressman. And if you're lucky, you'll get ushered in for 30 seconds, get a photo shoot, and be ushered back out the door. Drop a check at the front counter for $5,000 for the contribution for that year and ask them for a luncheon appointment, I'll guarantee you'll get one. That's bribery. It's not a contribution when that's what it gets you. And that's what we've allowed to happen within the country. And at this point, so much is being driven by that military-industrial complex and those that benefit by it, that who are the losers? You know, the big losers, you know, the Halliburton scandal recently, you know, the overcharge on fuel. People are going, well, you know, an overcharge on fuel, you know, how can that be? It's $1 a gallon overcharge on fuel. You know, I mean, that's something that you just don't make a clerical error on. When they traced it out, it turns out the company's related to the royal family, and it's another bribe. And who do they have looking at that to make sure that it wasn't done corruptly? The Pentagon. You know, it's send the fox into the chicken coop and make the count. You know, it's not going to work. And it's that lack of accountability is the big issue. The next thing that happened with our efforts in Europe on this, Tom Spencer took it on. And he was, when we finished our testimony in the hearing, State Department sent someone over for 2 weeks, going to every political person that was in that room, whether they were active on the committee or sitting in the audience, and tried to influence their perception of what we were doing by discrediting our work and discrediting us. Which is, you know, politicians understand this. I grew up in it. I understand it. It is, if you can't deal with the issues, you try and attack the individual. But politicians know this game, so they didn't buy in. And they also didn't know, or weren't, their intelligence wasn't as effective as it should have been, because they should have known we'd already been there a half a dozen times. We had spent time with each of these people, and we delivered, by the time we went into testimony, 3 feet of documents that had been analyzed by their research teams and put into briefing papers for these folks. And they weren't our words, they were our government's words, where our allies were not clued in public literature. That is strategically a disaster. Now you introduce these new concepts where I started, preemptive warfare, the idea of wiping someone out because you think they might do something. That violates every traditional value in this country about innocence and guilt from a fundamental level. Then you add into that speed of light weapon systems that can take that adversary out in the twinkling of an eye. What happens when our adversaries develop those same systems and target us? Will they? I think they will. Again, we can't abandon those traditional values because they drive everything. And that's what's happened in the last 10 years. This revolution in military affairs is a revolution against humanity. It's a revolution against every one of us in this room, and every one of us in this room are paying for it in multitudes of ways. The end result is it's a degradation of what happens environmentally, it's a degradation of what happens socially, and it's a limit on what's possible in terms of human potentials. That's what's being missed. When we engaged this effort in Alaska, people said, you know, you're so far removed, you know, how are you going to impact this? There were two of us. There's still two of us. People said, you should organize a group, organize an event. I don't organize groups, because this is the organization I'm a part of, and the one that you're a part of, and the one that's already organized. It's the organic internet. It's called the human race. We don't need to organize anything else. We just need to act on what we know to be right and true and begin to do something about it. And that's not in some big way necessarily. In fact, probably it's not. It's, you know, I used to contemplate as a young person what faith was, you know, and it was supposed to be this big mystery. You know what it is in simple terms for me? It's knowing something internally and stepping into it with an action that furthers what it is that you are internalizing. Externalize it. That's the act of faith, stepping into what you know to be right and true and acting on it. And being big enough and smart enough so that if you get in trouble on the idea, that you can back off, accept your mistakes, grow from that, and move forward. And everyone in the room with a little bit of gray hair knows one thing. Where do we learn the best? Where do we learn the most? Where do we learn the things that impacted our lives in the most dramatic way? It was in the disasters that hit us in life, not on those rosy moments. So, you know, even stepping into it, you run into things. But this is what I've said to people all around the country is, pick an issue that's near and dear to your heart. Do what you know you can do about that issue. Not what you think you can do, but what you absolutely, positively know you can do. And that is your sphere of influence at the moment. And what you will find in following each step along that route is you'll look back at a trail you never thought you would travel. Everyone in this room has the potential to do way more than I ever did, way more than anyone else has ever done. Every major change in the world has happened by one or two people saying, I don't quite see it the same way, and acting on it. And in conclusion, that's my message to everyone in this room, is find those issues that are important to you, act on those issues, and you will change the world. You'll change the way the world is perceived, and you'll change the way people perceive it. And you can do that one bite at a time, or you can do it talking to 5 million people on a radio show one evening. But the fact is, you can do it if you act on what you know.
You've been listening to author and researcher Nick Begich speaking at the 3rd Annual Sustainable Living Conference in Olympia, Washington last February. Thanks to Charles Caden and Mike McCormick for their contributions to this week's program. You can contact us or download Unwelcome Guests programs in MP3 at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.